Time, listener-supported KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, June 18th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Chi, Shawa, Toks Nusum, Salamat. Thank you so much for joining the conversation. You can also join us via our live stream for a behind-the-scenes look here in the studio on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Facebook and Instagram pages. Today, is it true that only fools run at night? Well, you can find out this Friday, June 20th, as Juno Trail and Roadrunners sponsors this annual fun run. We'll hear how you can get involved. Pride Month enters its final week or so. Summer is here to share with us the many events still to come happening around Juno. And the USDA Forest Service shares updates on the next steps in the Tongass Forest Revision Plan, plus the latest on happenings out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Those conversations, plus the latest Curious Juno and Our Living Lands, this hour on Juno Afternoon. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
As KTOO heads towards the end of its fiscal year on June 30th, we want to take a moment to thank every one of our current members and invite those of you who have never given to join now. Your contribution will be put to work bringing you the programming you love and rely on. Give today at ktoo.org.
Couple of quick announcements before we begin today. KTOO sister station KXLL has a new voice. DJ Kelly is spinning tunes and talking music every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at 4 p.m. right after Juno Afternoon. So you can hop on over to KXLL 100.7 or 101.7 or online at ktoo.org/listen to get your jam on. Also, tomorrow is an observed holiday here at KTOO. It's Juneteenth. In place of Juno Afternoon tomorrow, we have a special episode of 1A with Jen White. We'll be back on Friday for more Juno Afternoon. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kakuan Ish George Davis. And the word this week is tan.
Tan.
That means sea lion. And here is a sentence.
Tan ich kat a.
The sea lion sits on the submerged boulder. Let's hear it again.
Tan.
Sea lion. Gunash Chis Chu Hune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Kakuan Ish George Davis was Akhtain Tan and the child of a Tsagwe Di man. He grew up in Qiq, Cake, Alaska, and learned to speak well because he would always bring traditional foods to the elders there. As someone who fished a lot and spent time on the land, he knew Tlingit place names all over the area, and he learned many stories and advanced ways of speaking.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream in the studio here behind the scenes on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. The tradition is back once again, and now it's continued at an earlier time, although it's been that way for, I think, a couple years. It's the Only Fools Run at Night, formerly known as the Only Fools Run at Midnight, and it's organized now by Juneau Trail and Road Runners, and it serves as a fundraiser for the high school cross-country team. And to share more with me now, I have in the studio Abby John, as well as Zach Purcell, two coaches over at the cross-country team. Yeah?
That's right.
Awesome. All right. Gunnath Chish, Abby, how are you today? Wasiyati.
Good. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm excellent. And Zach, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having us.
Of course. Yeah, it's so exciting. So this is, just to set the stage, is this Friday.
Yes.
What time?
So the race starts at 9 p.m. Same day registration in person is at 7 p.m. at Centennial Hall. And then the costume event is at 8:15.
8:15. Okay. And then the run is at 9.
The run is at 9. So okay. Come on down at 7 o'clock and we'll have music playing. We'll have, you can pick up your T-shirt if you pre-registered with a T-shirt. And just have a good time before the race starts.
That's awesome. And when did you all take it over? Was it last year for the first time, or was it one year before that? Or is this your first year?
We took it over last year.
Okay.
And so this will be our second year of running the race.
Yeah, and it's had a few different homes. Even KTOO had it for 1 year.
That's
I think
right.
We did
yeah.
it like a few years back, like 2018 maybe or something. I can't remember, but it was a long time ago. And so when the opportunity arose, was it you, Abby, who picked it up, or Zach? How did you guys get the inheritance of the Only Fools Run at Night?
So I think we had spoken with Tristan Knutson-Lombardo, who had previously organized it for sale.
Yeah.
And he sort of acknowledged it as a good fundraising opportunity if somebody wanted to pick it up in the future. And we thought, what a way to combine running, a fun summer solstice event, and a community event, and get our kids out there and make some money for all of our traveling and team needs in the fall.
Yeah, absolutely. And Zach, tell me a little bit about the cross-country team and what kind of stuff y'all do.
Sure. Well, I mean, and just looking back at the Fool's Run, too, it fits in so well with what we do with the cross-country team here. I mean, we love running. We get out and run these trails. It's very serious in a way, but then also we love having fun. We love goofing around, like wearing costumes and stuff, going out in the middle of the night. Fits in perfectly with what we do. We just like love having a good time. So the cross-country team, it's a high school sport like any other. We're really huge. We had like 70, 60-something athletes last year.
Wow.
And it's all ranges of ability level. No cuts are made to the team. We're all just getting out and running in one huge pack every day after school.
And it's is there cool. still like a – does it break down like varsity and junior varsity and all that stuff, or is it all one thing now?
Yeah, we end up having a competitive varsity team that like competes at the state meet. So okay. We have 7 athletes that end up going there. But if you come to a cross-country race in Juneau, you will not be able to tell the difference between like if there's a varsity or JV race. We all race in one big giant horde.
So it's all based on time. Is that how it works? Or?
Yeah, it ends up being on, well, you end up scoring in a meet as a team.
Okay.
And so you will place as a team in a big race. And so that ends up being based on place.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I was more of the footballer. I didn't really do the cross country. So tell me, Abby, what kind of events are there? Is it long distance mostly since it's the cross country team, or do you still also do like short sprints and stuff?
We just do 5Ks.
Okay.
Occasionally early on in the season, we might do a shorter race, or sometimes in Juneau, we'll do like a dual meet or a relay, something fun to mix it up early season just to get people excited and build more camaraderie. But yeah, most of our focus for training and racing is on 5Ks.
I see. Okay. And does it go like year round?
It's just a fall sport.
So it's just a fall, sport. Okay.
So you might be thinking about track and field. That's in the spring.
Okay, that's in the spring. And that also has some – that has more sprints and
right.
1,500 meters or things like that. Okay, I get it. I get it. Because I know that – well, what I know is in, through Tristan and Mary Ellison and those types, I know they're a little nutty. And they run – you guys run all year round, don't you? Don't you run in the rain and the sleet and all that kind of stuff?
We sure do, yeah.
You can't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, that. Right? Yep. That's what I think. I love the runners because, like you said, Zach, they it's a serious sport, and it's definitely a you know it's awesome. But then also, it seems like many of the runners have like an inherent silliness to them, which I think is cool. So tell me about this costume. Is there a theme for this costume contest this year, Abby?
No, there's no theme, but we do have different categories. So there's individual costumes and group costumes. And in the past, I know there's been some pretty cool group costumes for the Only Fools races.
Okay.
So I'm excited to see what people come up with. We have some really amazing prizes this year from some of our local businesses, from Pavitt's, from Allen Marine, from Juno Greens, from NAO. So it should be there should be a lot for everyone if you come with a costume.
That's awesome. I think I remember one year when it was still the At Midnight thing, like, I think they did like a zombie theme or something, and people were running around in zombie costumes, which was pretty funny. I think that would be, although it's happening basically on the solstice this year, so it won't be as dark, maybe, right? With it.
Yeah, we won't be truly running at night. It'll still be during the day, but maybe in the future we can bring in a theme.
Yeah, it'd be fun to see it. Yeah, that'd be awesome. So who can participate in this run? Is it open to everyone or is it only open to students?
It's open to everyone. So yeah, so we've got a kid pricing and we've got an adult pricing. So for kids under 18, it's $15, and for adults, it's $25.
Okay, and you get a T-shirt with that?
So if you registered by June 1st, you could purchase a T-shirt with your registration, but we only have a few T-shirts left.
So. I see. So you got to be on the early bird, on the early schedule on that one. Okay. And then, Zach, Abby was mentioning that this is a fundraiser for the team for travel costs and stuff. Where do you all go in the fall? Where do you head out to?
Well, we travel as a cross-country team. We travel all over Southeast for our meets. So primarily, we'll end up in towns like Haines, Skagway, Sitka, Ketchikan. But we've traveled to pretty much all of the small towns over the years in Southeast. We'll take a trip up to Anchorage for the state meet. And usually we'll go up to Anchorage one more time earlier in the year just to like check out the state course
yeah.
for our competitive runners. But yeah, we used to be able to load the whole team up onto the ferry, which was pretty cool. The schedules yeah. don't really allow for us to do that as easily now. So travel's pretty expensive. So this fundraising part of what we do has become like more and more important, more and more of a priority.
I see.
As yeah. that change has happened.
That's kind of cool. It is nice to get on the ferry, but I guess flying is a little more convenient, but more expensive, right?
So yeah, that's right.
So you made me think about something here, Zach. Abby, do the courses change every year? Do they move it around?
For the
different events, like do they choose different parts of the town to make the 5K happen?
So for our home cross country meets, our home course is at Sandy Beach.
Okay.
But sometimes we'll go do a race up at Eagle Crest, or we might go out to Eagle Beach and run at the campground there if we feel like mixing it up. So really just, trying to keep things interesting and keep kids engaged. But we do most of our training at Sandy Beach.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. All right, so now I want to ask you guys a couple questions of how you work as coaches. Like, I'm just curious about that because the team is 70 kids, right? Is it just you two or are there other coaches?
We're so lucky to have a bunch of coaches who are in there with us. You've got to divide and conquer with
yeah.
a group that big.
Yeah.
So we've got a whole crew of assistant volunteer coaches. And yeah, it's a matter of making sure that no one's slipping through the cracks. So like if we're doing a workout, we'll have one coach working with one particular group of athletes. And so that way everyone's getting attention. No one's getting left behind.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a bit of a challenge with such a big group.
How did you get into coaching, Zach?
Well, you mentioned Mary Ellison.
Uh-huh.
She, I think the way it went was she like ran into me at Fred Meyer or something when I came back to Juno after college and was like, hey, you should come to practice and help out sometime. And I didn't really know how to say no.
And, it's hard to say no to Mary.
Spiraled out of control from there. Yeah. So that was probably like 7-8 years ago now. And yeah, now I'm one of the head coaches. So
that's pretty great. Just
kind of a natural process, but yeah.
And how did running come into being for you? Have you always been doing it since you were a kid or what?
Yeah, my parents were really into running in the Juneau community. I was always doing these Southeast Roadrunner races growing up. And the only Fool's Run at Midnight in particular was one of the really fun ones that I looked forward to. So
yeah,
it's just kind of always a thing I've been in.
Yeah, yeah. And it feels like, Abby, like running is not just something you do, but it's a way of life. Is that accurate?
I think you could say that for some people. Yeah, I think that we really like to build community where running is a part of that, and you know, give the kids a tool that they can take with them as they move on from high school. You know, something that you can do, you just throw on a pair of shoes and go for a run, and so it really like gives you an opportunity to de-stress or a way to connect with other people or challenge yourself. So I think running is a really cool way to just exist. Yeah.
And how did you get into coaching?
So I ran in high school and college, and after I moved back to Alaska, I was just looking for ways to plug into the community. And so I started coaching track when I was living in Anchorage. And then when I moved to Juneau, I got connected with the team here and just really liked what I saw and the narrative that they'd built in the community that they'd built, and just wanted to get in on it and see what it was all about.
That's cool. And you said you started running in college?
In high school.
In high school. Okay. Yeah. Were you part of the team?
Yeah, I was. I grew up in the Matsu Valley, so I ran cross country there and track and skied and really thought it was a super fun way to just be a kid outside after school.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you said something that I really like, which is, and even if you can't run, a walk is also something that is very cool. Like, it just clears your mind, right?
Yeah.
It just gets you out into the open air, and especially even if you do it by yourself, I always feel like it's nice to just take a stroll or take a jog, take a run, whatever it is, and get away from your phone, get away from anything that you have to think about. It kind of opens the mind. Do you guys find that helps the students too in terms of their focus, like in terms of getting away from the stress of being a teenager and in high school and stuff?
I really think it does. Yeah, it just gives them an opportunity to pause for a little bit and, you know, put everything on hold and just be outside and laugh with their friends and just be in the fresh air for a little bit.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. This is the only Fool's Run at Night. It's the Juneau Track and Roadrunners, Juneau Trail and Roadrunners is the sponsor. It's serving as a fundraiser for the high school cross country team, which Abby and Zach are coaches for. It's to help raise some money for their fall travel needs. So how do people find this race? Where do we go to register or find out more information?
Yeah, so you can search Only Fools Run at Night in Juneau, and the registration link will pop up online. It's also posted on Facebook and Instagram for Juneau Trail and Roadrunners. There's posters all around town. You can just scan the QR code. There's a few at breweries. So you can register online up until 6 p.m. on the day of.
Or you probably show up, too,
and register,
right?
Or you can just show up, yeah, and register in person.
And we want to mention again that the event, the run is at 9, but there's actually things that happen at 7. Go over that one more time, Abby, for people just tuning in.
Yeah, so if you want to do same-day registration in person, show up at 7 p.m. And then we'll have music playing. It'll be fun to gather. And then we have a costume contest starting at 8:15 before the race begins, and lots of prizes for that. Thanks to our sponsors, Juneau Bone & Joint, Allen Marine, AAL&P, Foodland, Juneau Greens, MRV Architects, NAO, and Pavitt's Health and Fitness. And then the race begins at 9, so we're excited to see you.
Awesome. That sounds so good. Again, you can just use your favorite search engine and search Only Fools Run at Night Juneau. You'll figure it all out. Again, proceeds benefit the Juneau High School Cross Country Team. What could be better, right? Abby, Zach, thank you. I think we got it all in, yeah?
I think so.
Awesome.
I think so. Thank you.
Good enough cheese for being here. I really appreciate it. And don't break a leg. I say break a leg because I'm from the theater, but I guess it's really weird to tell runners that. Is there something you say before a run to people? Like, in terms of, like, do you say good luck or do you say have fun? What do you say to runners before you start a race?
You can tell them break a leg. That's kind of funny.
Start that tradition.
I think they would get it.
Start that tradition. That's pretty cute. Okay, thanks so much for joining us. Good, Cheesh.
Thank you.
Okay. And now the latest episode of Curious Juno, which tackles the question that gets raised on a fairly consistent basis. Why is Juno the state capital and not Anchorage? Here's KTO's Clarice Larson's look into the answer.
It's a question that has swirled around town for decades, often with some heated debate. Why is the state capital Juno and not Anchorage? Kirk Smith is a volunteer with the Juno Douglas City Museum, which works together with the Capitol Building to provide tours during the summer tourism season.
Well, the question does come up quite frequently, you know, why is a city that's inaccessible by road or rail, why is it the capital?
For this Curious Juno, a listener asked us to take a look at where the question and the debate stands. Smith has been giving tours of the Alaska State Capitol since 2018, so he knows the building, its history, and its artwork like the back of his hand. He starts each tour in the Senate Finance Committee hearing room, where a painting of Sitka hangs on the wall.
Major issues that affect Alaskans are decided in this room.
He explained that the painting is there because Juno wasn't actually the first capital of Alaska. Sitka was. But that changed in 1906.
Juno was the largest and wealthiest and most successful city in the territory in 1900 when the Congress actually mandated moving the capital to Juno. Anchorage existed in that time, in a sense. It was a small community.
But Juno wasn't the state capital yet because Alaska wasn't a state yet. It was a territory. The Capitol Building was built in 1929 and opened in 1931 as a federal and territorial building.
I like to refer to the architectural style as early 20th century American post office.
The federal government then gifted the building to the state when Alaska became the 49th state of the Union in 1959. In the decades since then, there have been multiple attempts to move the capital to a more populated area, and some of them almost succeeded. In 1974, Alaska voters passed an initiative to move the capital to the road system. But a measure to fund the move failed, as did four other capital move votes in 1960, 1962, 1994, and 2002.
It's a little bit like the zombie movie. It's never all the way dead.
Juno Democratic Senator Jesse Keel says, despite the many failed attempts, there's always going to be a new effort to move the capital onto the road system.
You can count on it to come back, smelly and shambling and still a problem that has to be dealt with.
When Juno became the territorial capital in 1906, Anchorage wasn't the hub that it is today. But now Anchorage's population is roughly 9 times the size of Juno's population. And over the years, a lot of state jobs have migrated there. So much so that the movement coined the name Capital Creep, the slow trickle of state jobs moving away from Juno and into Anchorage. Keel says he's obviously biased because he lives here, but argues there are numerous reasons why Juno should remain the capital despite the movement away. For one...
Oh, good Lord in heaven, the price tag. I have no idea what that price tag would be. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars at least. And that's probably a lowball estimate.
He says that Juno's identity as a town is intertwined with it being the capital of the state. Other states like California, New York, Texas, and Montana all have their capitals in locations that aren't the most populated area of their respective states. But House Representative George Rauscher, a Republican from Sutton, says holding the Alaska legislature at the Alaska state capitol in Juno is a disservice to Alaskans.
It costs so very much money for our legislative constituents to come down and see us.
Since 2017, Rauscher has introduced a bill each session in the Alaska legislature seeking to have lawmakers convene in Anchorage instead of Juno. He argues that Juno is inconvenient and expensive for everyone who is not local and too far away from the state's big population centers.
And this is the only state on the planet where people have to take a boat or an airplane to go to do the work of the people.
His bill didn't go anywhere last session, nor has it ever in previous years. But there's always the chance it could get picked back up next session in January. But every time the issue springs up, so does opposition. Here's Keel again.
As long as we remain dedicated and vigilant, I think we can continue to hold this off and keep this smelly old zombie that tries to shamble out of the crypt periodically from threatening the town. But you'll never stop it from getting reanimated by somebody somewhere.
In Juneau, Alaska's capital, I'm Clarice Larson.
Hans and Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta ka na khaya ha an ka gun chish.
Today is Wednesday, June 18th, and on this day in 1954, at Mile 5 on Glacier Highway, a classified $500,000 project to build several steel towers and support facilities for the U.S. Signal Corps was underway. No purpose for the project was given. It was a secret communications project for the military before the towers were removed, leaving just the concrete blocks that are still there today. To learn more about those mysterious blocks, see the Curious Juno episode by Trip Krause from February of 2018, titled Juno's Concrete Blocks Spark Tall Tales About Their Origins. Find it at ktoo.org. That's a look back at this day in 1954.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. That was Mike Lane with the On the Day segment. You can catch Mike Lane every morning on Morning Edition here on KTOO. Catch him between about 5 and 8:30 every morning. I'm Boston Christopher. Juno is National Pride Month, and SIGLA, the Southeast Alaska LGBTQ+ Alliance, has filled the calendar with events and sharing events from other groups as well on their calendar, because there's a lot going on. Summer Christensen joins us to help round out this month of events and tell us what's in store. Gunnath Chishwasiyati, how are you? Welcome.
Good. Gunnath Chish for having me.
Good to see you again. So we're like 10 days from the end of the month or so, I think.
It's happening fast.
But so you've had so much happening. You were telling me just before we went on air that you had the tie-dye event yesterday and there's so many people came, you ran out of supplies.
Yeah, which is always a good problem to have.
That's a good thing, right? That's a good thing. And so there's a lot going on, including the Pride Prom, which is going to be happening this Saturday. We'll talk about that. There's the dog walk that's happening later today, right? The
Dog Park Party.
Dog Park Party. Okay.
Yeah, which last time we got lucky, it was on a sunny day, and we had over 17 people and like over 20 dogs all wearing cute little rainbow bandanas. So that was pretty adorable.
That was last Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was a really beautiful day after all the rain that we had, I think, as I recall. Okay, so let's just go down the calendar. We're starting with today with the dog park party, right? That's what's happening today. What else is coming up? Let us know.
The next big SIGLA event. So if you go to our website, aksigla.org, you should be able to find the Google spreadsheet, which can show you all of this. But the next big SIGLA event is this Friday, the 20th. It's the pub crawl. And then there's going to be an after party at the Alaskan. So you can meet us at Devil's Club. We're going to start there, head back to Amalga. Then we'll head to the Crystal and then the Grizz. And then the Alaskan, I believe, starts at 9 p.m.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that'll be a big, fun one. But then one of our biggest events of the month is on Saturday at the Jack. It's our Pride Prom.
Okay.
It's from 5 to 9, and it's all ages. So we like to do an all-ages event, and then there's an after party at the Alaskan. That way, if you just want to be around adults, you're welcome to. But I think Pride Prom will be really good. The theme is D&D.
D&D as in Dungeons & Dragons?
Yeah, which it's really funny. So many of our events this year are D&D themed, and I've never played. And so I'm just like asking people around me, like, what do I do?
Is Trip Krause involved in organizing some of these events? Because I know D&D.
They were at Bloomfest, but they couldn't help out for some of the other events.
I see. Okay. Yeah, because I know D&D is getting, it's growing in popularity again.
It seems like it's super popular.
Creating these groups and getting together and doing these campaigns, and it's just a great way to socialize. It's really fun.
Yeah, we had a one-shot campaign night at the library, and it was kind of like a RSVP thing, and every spot was taken up, and it was a huge event.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm excited for Pride. If you are like me and you don't understand D&D, just think fantasy.
Fantasy.
Magic.
Probably if you've read any like fantasy, dragons and or, you know, that era, you know, armor, things like that. Yeah. That's kind of fun.
And we're going to be borrowing a bunch of decorations from the Master's Fair, the kind of Renaissance fair that happens in July. One of my best friends runs that, so we're kind of giving each other decorations.
Oh, nice.
Events, so,
yeah.
Yeah.
And is there some of the stuff I know I just is free, like the dog park party doesn't cost anything, but the prom, probably because it's at the Jack and you're paying rental or whatever, is there a cost to go to the prom?
It is totally free.
Oh, it's free.
Yeah, but like Bloomfest, we're asking for a suggested donation of $10 just because, yes, we have to pay for the rental and we'll be paying for food. But just know that all of your donations go straight back to SIGLA to put on more events like this. So.
To make more events happen. Yeah, absolutely. And again, just remind us again, the time on Saturday for the Pride Prom is?
Saturday, that'll be from 5 to 8 at the Jack, and then starting about 8:39-ish at the Alaskan for the 21 over.
But the Pride Prom is all ages. Okay.
Yep.
And is there, do you have to register or do you just show up?
Nope, just show up. Okay. There's going to be a DJ. We're going to have food. There's going to be some D&D themed activities. We'll also have this year kind of a quiet room if things get overwhelming with all the music. It should be a good time.
Wow, absolutely. That sounds really fun. Okay, and that's on Saturday, but that's not the end of the month.
No, and then Sunday, PFLAG has their big picnic, which is from 12 to 2 at Sandy Beach. But the new thing this year is SIGLA is going to march down to the picnic. So if you want to be part of a Pride March, we are going to meet at the top of, what is it, Savico Road, kind of where... There's the Fish and Game Building and then Juno Montessori School. So
Up there somewhere, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
And then we are going to have little signs. You can march on down to the picnic and then have a good time.
Sweet, and that's on Sunday, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then there's still like a whole week left, right?
Yeah, so we'll have our regular pet parade, so you can bring your pet down to Sandy Beach on Monday.
Oh my God.
Monday from 6 to 7:30. Last year was really funny. Somebody brought their cat in one of those backpacks where it has kind of the bubbles so you can see the cat. So they decorated the backpack.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Yeah.
And then the cat's face was just in the bubble.
Yeah, looking a little terrified.
That's hilarious.
But that's a really fun one. Even if you don't have a pet, people come down just to see pets walk the red carpet. We have a red carpet that we pull out.
And where does that take place?
Sandy Beach.
Sandy
so hopefully
Beach?
The weather's nice.
On if Monday afternoon.
Yeah, if it's not, we get the shelter too, so we can just do it in the shelter.
I see.
Yeah.
And of course, everything that Summer is saying, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Summer Christensen from SIGLA. We're talking about the Pride Month events. Everything can be found on a Google sheet, which is linked at aksigla.org. I'm sure it's also on your Facebook page, and it's updated. So if anything else comes up, it will be updated, and that Google link has all the different events. We're just sort of going over it so everybody gets a sense of what's happening the rest of this month.
Yeah, a lot's happening.
Yeah, a lot's happening.
What are some of the big ones? So, yeah, we'll have trivia, Pride trivia. This will be at Devil's Club. An important thing to know about this one, it costs $2 in cash. So you have to bring two whole dollars in cash.
Two greenbacks.
Yeah, but that goes into the pot. Connor Lendrum was kind enough to turn his regular trivia night at Devil's Club into a Pride trivia. So we're very excited.
So then somebody wins the pot.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Big deal.
That's another thing that's off the chains here in Juneau.
Trivia.
Is the trivias.
I know.
The trivia night. That's awesome. Okay.
Yeah. And then we're going to have a Pride movie series. This will be next Wednesday. So we're going to be doing a double feature of Before Stonewall, After Stonewall. And that'll be at the Gold Town Theater from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m.
Okay.
Yeah. And I believe it's free. You just, if you want concessions.
Oh, right, right, right. The yummy real popcorn with real butter.
I know.
Yeah, right?
Dangerous.
Gold Town, thank you.
And then Thursday, Legends and Lattes, which is our first ever Pride Month book club from 6 to 8 at Forbidden Peak.
Legends and Lattes. That also sounds a little bit like a D&D thing.
But... I know, everything this year. It just magically happened. And we have included a link. It's helpful if you RSVP just so we know how many people are coming.
For Forbidden Peak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm trying to look. I was amazed the Rock Dump reached out to us this past week. They wanted to do one more event, so the queer rock climbing, that'll be at the Rock Dump on Friday the 27th. But that's also Glitz weekend, so it's going to be a big weekend.
Wow.
Yeah. And then Saturday, we have our annual trans pool party from 2:30 to 4:30 at the downtown pool. And Sunday, we have family fun at Capitol Park from 11 to 1. So we'll have activities for kids, families. A scavenger hunt, which we'll have more details on our website about it. And then finally, we've made it, Monday the 30th, end of Pride yoga and meditation at the Rainforest Yoga Studio from 6:45 to 8 p.m.
I think after all the events, you need some yoga and meditation.
Yeah, so I'll be running that, but it's going to be a very chill hour of yoga.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Yeah, again, of course, now we talk about this. I want to mention this again, too, because everyone is welcome to most of these events. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of events that maybe allies you want to say, hey, maybe this is only for the queer folk, right?
Yeah. So the main ones would just be the trans pool party.
Yeah.
It would probably make sense to not come to that one if you're not transgender. And the end of Pride yoga and meditation, that one kind of just giving those spots to LGBTQIA people.
Got it. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, happy Pride Month, Summer.
Thank you.
Thank you again for coming in and sharing the rest of the schedule, the agenda. I know you're really one of the main people responsible for making this happen. And so I hope you can stay awake and...
Yeah, I'm getting tired.
And keep your energy up as the month continues. You can find out more again. It's SEGLA, the Southeast Alaska LGBTQ+ Alliance. They have a full calendar of events for the rest of this month, and you can find out more over at aksegla.org. Really appreciate you being here, Summer. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you. Ganesh.
Okay, and now we have this week's edition of Our Living Lands from Native Voice One, all about how Indigenous skiers are reckoning with climate change and exclusion. You are listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Climate change is putting snow sports like skiing at risk. For Indigenous skiers, that adds to a long history of exclusion from the sport. Let My People Go Skiing is a new film about access to snow sports for Alaska Native youth. Our Living Lands producer, Daniel Spalding, spoke to Ellen Bradley, the film's director and a Tlingit skier, about what skiing means to Indigenous people.
What inspired you to tell this story through skiing, and how has returning to your traditional homeland shaped that journey?
Yeah, so for me, skiing is something that's always been a part of my life. And skiing was kind of this tool for connection with the lands that we were living on. It was this real, tangible way to connect with the Cascade Mountains and this place I was living that I didn't have the same blood ties or connection to like I do in Southeast Alaska. I feel really lucky that skiing has maintained being part of my life, but has become so central to my life and what I'm doing today as a professional skier, and hoping to use that as a tool to break down some of these barriers so that our Native people everywhere can access their homelands no matter what season it is.
And how have you seen climate change impact the skiing world?
You see so much change when it comes to climate change and snow sports. Snowpacks are significantly less consistent year by year. Often, like this last year, we saw very little snow here in the Rocky Mountains throughout the beginning of the year, and then it kind of all came at a certain time. And that's a little bit less consistent than what we've seen historically. More specific to my homelands in Juneau, they had a horrible snow year. So it's kind of a really scary time to be someone who loves the mountains when they're snowy, because it's changing, and changing in so many different ways that it's kind of hard to quantify at times.
In your documentary, Let My People Go Skiing, you work to dismantle barriers for Alaska Native youth. What kind of response have you received from the young people in your community?
From the young people in our community, I think their response in a lot of ways has just been joy. It feels like this really special place that is by us and for us, by Native people, for Native people, where we can really bring each other into community on the land, with the land. And I experienced that with the kids, just seeing them like have so much joy, learning how to move their bodies in this different ecosystem on these skis or snowboards in a way that is maybe a little funky to how they feel. It always reminds me that we're skiing or we're snowboarding because it is fun, and it to find more joy in that for myself as well.
Why is it important for Indigenous people to be the ones telling these stories, especially when it comes to the outdoor recreation world?
I mean, we were outdoor recreationalists before that was even a term, right? As Indigenous people, that's just our lifestyle. And I think our narratives being centered in that space, centered around stories about our experiences with the land and the way that we move with the land, is so important, because in this capitalist colonized culture that we've now found ourselves in today, being able to be on the land and move with the land is abnormal. And so to be able to return to our people's cultures of being in this right relationship and movement with the land, I think is central to determining where the outdoor industry or outdoor recreationalists should be going, or where the focus should be.
How do you balance traditional ecological knowledge with Western science in your advocacy, and what gives you hope in the fight to protect your homelands and culture?
Alaska's a vast, diverse space with so many different ecosystems. And in order to have lived in these spaces for as long as we have, we all had to be scientists. And so for me, trying to meld those two in the modern day and age feels like trying to remind science that its origins are in Indigenous ways of knowing. And trying to explain to Indigenous ways of knowing or traditional ecological knowledge that your knowledge is complete, right? That it isn't less than Western science in the ways that Western science often tries to make other ways of knowing feel less than itself. There's so much that's giving me hope these days in the fight to protect my homelands and my culture. There are so many incredible people, Tlingit people, Alaska Natives, Indigenous peoples everywhere that have found their ways and their abilities to engage in that fight for protection. And I think being able to see all of the different people who are approaching our fight for protection, for culture, and for land in these different ways, that's what's giving me hope.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO, dedicated to Callan Hobbs Peterson. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. I'm joined now once again by Barb Miranda from the USDA Forest Service, and we have some cool updates to talk about, a little bit of the Tongass Forest Plan revision, as well as some other happenings on the Tongass.
Yeah.
So, gunnith cheese for being here, Barb.
Gunnith cheese for having me. It's good to be here, as always.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. Now, so I was excited to hear, because we're moving forward with something on the Tongass Forest Plan revision.
We're going to get the first, we're going to release the draft, the final assessment.
So the final assessment is going to get released in July. And for those of you that might have listened before, that is the compilation of knowledge about the Tongass, the best available scientific and indigenous knowledge that we have available to provide the foundation for building the master plan for the Tongass National Forest.
Yeah, that's going to be so cool.
So we're going to get that out. We are assessing when we will move forward with the whole forest planning effort, but we're delighted to have this first big significant chunk completed in July, and we'll get that out to the public.
So just to remind folks who may not have heard before, what is the Tongass Forest Plan revision and why are we doing it?
So the Tongass Forest Plan revision is the master plan for the Tongass. The last time we did a full complete planning document that we're required to do by law was in 1997. We've had updates since then, but it's been a long time since we've done a thorough and complete forest plan. And as you know, Boston, everything has changed in Southeast Alaska since 1997. So it's time for an update for that plan, and we're looking forward to moving forward on it. And this is one of the big foundational pieces, and we're excited to get it done. We've done a ton of public engagement on it, traveled around in 2024 to all the communities, and have really received a lot of comments and input. And we even worked, we worked really closely with Spruce Root to get all the tribes' input on how the Tongass should be managed. Of course, the Tongass is the homeland for all the tribes that have lived here since time immemorial. So it's kind of a humbling honor to be working on a plan with them. And in the spirit of co-stewardship, you know, just really taking a look at how we can move forward.
Absolutely.
On planning for the Tongass for the future.
Now, some folks may say, why since 1997? But isn't it like a law or something that it has to be done every 25 years
It's a lot. It's a law to have it done actually in a shorter time frame.
Shorter time, okay.
Than that. But we've had significant updates since then. So we're still in the clear. We're not breaking the law.
You're not getting fined.
But it is time to move forward with an updated plan.
Is there any, can you give me any hint or insight into some of the things that maybe you found?
Oh, well, I'm super excited about the Tongass, an indigenous place component of the assessment. That piece written from the perspective of tribes and trying to incorporate all the things we heard is already being called the gold standard, and we couldn't think. We contracted with Spruce Root to collect that information, and we just had some wonderful people working on that and really conducting, you know, engaging with tribes in a way that we haven't been able to in the past. So that I'm excited about that. But it you know, the assessment includes everything from geologic hazards to climate adaptation and resilience to, you know, all the information that's on species of conservation concern and different types of vegetation management options for building and sustaining resilient forests. So it's really a diverse document. It's quite large, but there will be some synthesis information and ways to get to shortcuts for that information.
Sounds like very comprehensive, but also categorized.
Yes.
Right? In terms of, because you're talking
like,
about.
There's like 17 different sections, but there will be one compilation document to sort of provide an overarching overview. But it's been a lot of work, and a lot of people have worked on it. And, you know, there's always new information coming in, and we will continue to build a strong foundation for moving forward with the planning for the Tongass when we're ready to do that. But I'm really excited to talk to you about the summer and what we've got going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
You know, it's summer
it's
finally
summertime.
Hit. Yeah, like, I feel like it just showed up, and here we are. But we've been preparing for summer for months because we have to do all sorts of safety training. With our tribes and partners, and we're out in the field now, doing a lot of amazing work. But safety training involves everything from chainsaw operations to boat handling to shoreline survival. So people have been going through training, but we have a big restoration project happening over in Cube Cove on Admiralty Island right now.
Ooh.
That is restoring land that we acquired that had been previously logged. And Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition has been our lead partner in this work. And we are restoring just a ton of salmon habitat and doing treatments in places that have been logged to bring old growth characteristics into those stands. And we're working really closely with the Kootsnuwu and Kikon community forest partnerships. Those are Cake and Angoon crews that are out there working with us. And it's just super exciting. We just got reports back from the field, and they're going to be blasting bridges this summer that have been put that were put in there for logging operations.
Wow.
It's wilderness.
Yeah.
So they're returning it to a more natural state and then removing culverts that are stopping fish passage and really doing a tremendous job on getting that area restored. So
amazing.
That's kind of exciting.
So is that like watershed restoration, is that the goal, is to get it back to more of its natural habitat?
We acquired that land and it became part of the Admiralty Wilderness area.
Mm.
And so to restore, to get it to into a position where it can more ably restore itself to a more natural condition is the goal of that project. And
that's
it's quite unique and quite large scale.
Yeah, wow, that's awesome. Yes.
So
you have more, I know.
Yeah, there's a lot more.
There's a ton.
We also, continuing with the theme of partnerships, we have the Alaska Youth Stewards have been busy out there.
Mm.
These are tribally sponsored organizations, but Tlingit and Haida takes the lead. We help fund and staff, but these are youth from Huna, Angoon, Cake, and Prince of Wales. They just met over in Gustavus and went into Glacier Bay for training all those youth all together. And so they had a kickoff training, and those youth are going to be working across the Tongass and on tribal lands as well, learning work skills that's sort of the feeder to be able to work on the Community Forest Partnership crews or for the Forest Service or for the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition. These youth are learning skills that will help them have jobs in that sector.
How do people get involved in that?
Yeah, I think stay in tune to Tlingit and Haida's webpage. They are the ones that have
the
Alaska Youth Stewards Program.
Okay, tlingitandhaida.gov is their website. Yeah, go over there and figure that out. That's kind of cool because you get a lot of training, and then eventually that might be a career. And maybe they end up working on crews like the Cube Cove, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's kind of awesome.
It's been really fun to interact with those youth and see them progress into jobs, even with the Forest Service.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. And then I see something about kids fishing days.
Yeah, we have there's an annual kids fishing day, and they happen across the country. And that's an opportunity for families can enjoy a little fishing and hang out with some of the Forest Service employees in Huna. Sitka and Ketchikan have already completed their fishing days, but they're still coming up in Wrangell, Yakutat, Petersburg, and Prince of Wales. So check out the Tongass National Forest Facebook page. We'll have information about those.
Okay, that's what I was going to say, is where do I go?
Yeah. But those fishing days, the Glacier Bay National Park does it too in Gustavus. I've been involved in that in the past, and it's pretty fun to see the little kids out there catching fish.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I like that. And so you have a great Facebook page, because I know the government page is hard to find and everything, but find it on Facebook or just search USDA Forest Service Tongass Forest. But the Facebook page is going to have updates on like the kids fishing days and things like that, which is really cool. Cause those events are coming up, a couple more that you say are coming up. So that's kind of cool. And then there's something, about cultural trees being harvested in Ketchikan. What's that all about?
Yeah. So, the Tongass supports cultural tree use by the tribes. And so there's the Organized Village of Saxman down outside of Ketchikan. Has selected trees that they want to use to make totem poles out of.
Oh, awesome.
So they have been selected, and they get a free permit to have them harvested from the National Forest, and then they get to have their carvers carve them into kutie, and they get put up there at the I don't know if you've ever been to that totem park out by Saxman, but that's...
I haven't, but I know that we're also, I know that they're still commissioning those that are going to be along the park trail here,
yeah.
The trail, the Cotija Pole Trail.
Yeah, so cultural trees are one of the things we provide on the Tongass.
I see.
They typically can be selected, and that you work with your local district to get those trees.
I would love to, like, interview a carver and find out, like, what they look for.
Right.
Like, what are you looking for when you're going into the forest to find, I mean, is there a certain kind of tree? Like, how big does it need to be?
Yeah, I think that that is some indigenous knowledge that is super interesting. And I mean, walking into a carving shed and smelling that cedar, it gives me goosebumps just thinking about it.
Yeah,
I've been
pretty...
in some pretty neat carving sheds, especially on Prince of Wales. And boy, talk about something that is really impressive. And I'm really glad that the Tongass can provide the trees to sustain that cultural practice.
I love that. It's so good. I mean, it is a giant forest.
It is a giant forest, but those trees are very particular.
Yeah.
And from what I'm hearing, it's something that we need to manage for to make sure we have those.
Oh, I see. Okay. Something in the plan, right?
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
That'll be in the plan.
Yes,
yeah,
we will need to plan
back
for that.
Mm-hmm. And quickly before we run out of time, just give us a quick update on, I know it's been in the news a lot over the last couple months, but what's happening out at the Glacier Recreation Center?
Yeah, well, we're open. The visitor center is open 10 to 5. And of course, everybody that lives here in Juneau, you guys see the cruise ships, you know we're busy out there. But we've got wildlife visiting, and we have... staffing for those hours, and of course we couldn't run that place without Tlingit and Haida's cultural ambassadors being on site,
mm-hmm.
providing that wonderful education to the visitors, and then Discovery Southeast managing the bookstore out there. I don't know if you know, but Discovery Southeast uses the proceeds from that bookstore to fund all the youth education that they do here in Juneau. So it's a really nice symbiotic relationship with Tlingit and Haida and Discovery Southeast.
Oh, that's really cool. That's really happening. So give us the hours of the cultural center.
The visitor center out there is open from 10 to 5. Sunday through Friday. So not open on Saturday right now,
mm-hmm.
but Sunday through Friday. But the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area, that entire area, those hours haven't changed. It's open 6 to midnight.
Yeah, till it gets dark, which right now...
Right now, it's not. So
it's not.
Yeah.
So you can get out there and see it. It's kind of fun. And that's really great that the recreation area and the center has been able to be staffed. And again, it's really nice to see that Tlingit and Haida's cultural ambassadors are out there and Discovery Southeast pitching in as well. That's really cool. Barb Miranda from the USDA Forest Service on all kinds of cool things going on with the Tongass. I really appreciate you being here today. Gunnith Cheese for joining us.
Yeah.
And follow the Forest Service on their Facebook page.
Yes.
That's the easiest way to get all the details. Are you going to release the plan on there too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We'll
have a link to it and for sure. So that assessment will be available
on our
Facebook page. Yep.
Cool. Gunnith Cheese.
Gunnith Cheese.
All right. That's going to do it for today's Juneau Afternoon. Tomorrow, for the Juneteenth holiday, in place of Juneau Afternoon, you can catch a special episode of 1A with Jen White. And right now, you can hop over onto our sister station at 4 o'clock on KXLL at 100.7 or 101.7 to catch DJ Kelly and her new show airing every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at 4 p.m. Go catch some afternoon jams. Juneau Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juneau 104.3 and KAUK Juneau Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JuneauAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juneau Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you and Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juneau Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Lisa Purvis. Gunnith Cheesh, enjoy the lovely Juneau evening.